This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. Albemarle County's Lenny Sorensen is my idea of a good food foodie. Lenny lets good ingredients do their thing without too much fussing. And after trekking the long and winding road of her adventurous life, Lenny's now pretty much settled down to writing about food and teaching cooking. And like most life stories, I thought Lenny Sorensen's would best be served by starting at the beginning.
I was born in Southern California back a long time ago when Southern California was really small, small towns strung along, you know, the Southern California road called 101. I learned about food early because I was surrounded by really a lot of good food, not in a like upscale restaurant kind of way, but just a lot of good cooks. Black cooks in the Black community, there were wonderful Mexican cooks, there were a lot of Jewish cooks. There were a lot of Chinese cooks in small, like small mom and pop restaurants, that kind of stuff, delis, those, you know,
yum.
Much more than because there were no big chains or any of that stuff happening then. Southern California really was farm country when I was a kid. There was only one freeway. That was the Pasadena Freeway. And so from Los Angeles, this large name we put on this thing was actually many small towns that all were kind of lumped under the name of Los Angeles. And then I lived in San Diego as well. So in the counties, so when I was a kid, there were still hundreds of thousands of acres of orange trees and avocado orchards and lemon orchards and grapefruit orchards right in what are now, of course, and have been for easily 40 years, completely built suburban housing tract development. Okay, that was all only beginning to really be in place by the end of the 50s. So in the late 40s and early 50s, that was still real farm country, depending on how you lived and where you lived. And we just lived in a lot of places. Your neighbors could easily be a Mexican family who did what, you know, cooked in whatever they way cooked. Or you might know, we were a member of the Unitarian congregation, so we knew a lot of Jewish people and had food within that system. You know, I mean, I just knew a lot about, just had a lot of food exposure. My mother really loved to eat. She didn't like to cook.
Were you a gregarious family?
Oh, we were hardly a family at all. We were so dysfunctional that it doesn't even hardly bears even describing. But because my mother was a really avid, my mother was a communist and a socialist, you know, so she was really active in left-wing politics, which at that time had many social elements to it. And so within that atmosphere, I met lots of kinds of people who cooked all kinds of different ways, lots of incoming post-World War II immigrants coming. You know, all of those changes that the 50s brought, the early 50s, early to mid-50s brought with it. Anyway, I was exposed to a lot of food. My stepdad was a Black man from Algiers, Louisiana, born in 1914. Yeah, and while he came from the lowest, laboring class, working class, manual labor, whatever, he had all that food stuff that we know, you know, and from Southern Louisiana. So his mother died when he was young, so he had kind of the food repertory that a boy who's the oldest and has five siblings and whose father works all the time and who then left school in the third grade and becomes kind of the mother, you know, he could cook. I'm sure he had women in the community around them where they lived that could have taught him, helped him, whatever. But he did like to cook, and he did cook often and apparently was the cook in his family, from what I can gather. He's passed away quite a long time ago. But he then came out to California in 1937 and managed to, all of them ragtag siblings, as they are wont to do, followed him all out there, and he had to put them all into business and all that. You know, they were all ungrateful and hideous and, you know.
But anyway, and he kept cooking.
He would always cook in his home. Do you know what I mean? He just always. Mm-hmm. And so in our home, during the time my mother was married to him, he cooked, and I learned his repertory of cooking. And what was cool about it was, like I say, my mother didn't like to cook. She did like to eat, and she was very grateful about that. So when I started to cook, which was about when I was 9, she would do the dishes. So I never did dishes as a kid. I never understood anybody's whining and griping about it, because I never had to do dishes. I cooked the food. That was always the deal. You know, if you cook, you don't have to do the dishes, right? And so I learned to cook what he cooked, which part of it was, of course, I cooked what he liked. And I liked it, too. And it was very similar to that real basic Mexican kind of simple, you know, Mexicans were making, my friend Martha Gonzalez, her mother, you know, made fried nopal and fried potatoes and homemade tortillas and pinto bean soup and salsa, you know, fresh salsa, and sometimes some chicken, and she made tamales.
Good okay, eats.
Yeah, just your standard stuff.
All that meat and no potatoes just ain't right, like green tomatoes. Yeah, I'm waiting, palpitating, with all that meat and no potatoes.
It used to be really easy. It's hard for people to imagine that you could literally just got in your car and you drove to Mexico. And, you know, we went there a lot. I mean, even when I was a teenager, we would just get in our cars, you know, Paul pile in somebody's car and go to Tijuana and go to the bullfights and go to the whatever, you know. And so it was easy to go there. It was easy to eat whatever street food or whatever was there. And so with the food that Daddy Robert made, that had many kind of similarities. You know, it was beans and rice, you know, red beans and rice and ham hock. If you were flush, you had ham hock. That was cool. Cornbread, you know, fricasseed pork chops, fricasseed chicken, you know, long gravy, short gravy, collard greens, green beans, sweet potato pie. Very simple, very Southern, very, you know, but very, very simple. Nothing fancy because he didn't, you know, he didn't keep a big house. I didn't have any siblings. You know, it wasn't like we had a whole household full of folks, you know. And so I learned to cook that food, and I really love it. It's a kind of food, that kind of peasant food, be it Chinese, Japanese, Mexican, whatever. I literally could eat it every day. I don't get tired of it. And especially in places where if you spend any time, everybody else eats it every day, too. So what are those subtle differences that in a cuisine that's seemingly so simple and repetitive, what is it about that that helps us distinguish between the good cook, the fair cook, and the mediocre cook? Because they're not cooking different vocabularies of food. They're cooking much the same thing, but we all know it when we taste it. Someone's pinto beans, or someone's sweet potato pie, or someone's smothered pork chops are particularly lovely or succulent.
Still, I'm going back to Georgia, where I can get my red beans and rice.
How old were you when you first figured out that there was such a thing as really good cooking?
Well, I must say that Daddy helped define that in many ways, because he was... Of all the things that he might be voluble about, food was one. And he wasn't a very, very voluble person in any case. But I was the only chap he had, so you know, he was. Who else was he going to talk to? My mother didn't care about that stuff. So he had opinions, and I think, as we all do, of course, we graft on, you know, those early opinions to which we're exposed, and then we more or less buff them more. Otherwise, you know, some we discover years later are just wrong. You know, that was wrong. And then others we say, yeah, oh, yeah, that was always cool. I always knew, you know, I knew that, and I'm really glad. Well, Daddy had real opinions about cornbread, collard greens, how you did rice, how it was supposed to be when it was finished, when it was good and finished.
Give me, for instance.
Okay, the rice you should... well, first of all, you had to boil the water. Water had to be boiling, and you had to pour the rice into it and the salt, and then you put the lid back on, and you had to bring it back to a full boil, and then you had to drop it to the lowest fire you could, and you were never, ever, upon pain of death, to lift the lid. Now, of course, I discovered that that is not the truth. You can screw around with the rice. You can stir it. You can do all kinds of stuff. You can take the lid off for 15 minutes. Nobody cares. But I certainly learned to do it that way, and I still tend to do it that way because that's just the ritual way I do it. And there is basically no need to screw around the rice and stir it and do it and mess with it and, you know. And
leave
so that's
it alone.
Yes. And so that's kind of contributed, I think, to the way I teach, which is food is not rocket science. It's just food. We're going to do it. Do you know what I mean? And it's not, we don't have to make a big geschrei out of the food. The food, there are easy ways to do it. There's kind of straightforward ways to do it. And we don't have to get excited about the doing of it. You know, we just need to feed folks. That's our goal there.
All right, you have this sort of groundwork laid in letting good food, just messing around with it enough to cook it, and letting good food just be good food. And then here you are some decades later, living in Virginia, teaching food and an expert on some kinds of food. So what happened during those decades?
Well, I think with anything, you know, you just continue doing some part of it. And I always cooked as a teenager. You know, I was always the one that always cooked, that knew how to cook, that knew just from being in a pretty blunt, straightforward family, if you're going to drink, you got to eat. Okay? So none of that kind of, you know. And we used to be able to buy, you know, $2.25 a gallon San Antonio Red. It was, you know, it was so fresh that, you know, it practically dissolved the glass in the bottles. But that's what we drank, you know, on the beach, wherever we were. But you had to eat first. I mean, and I knew that. I was taught that. And so I learned to be able to say, okay, let's pitch on our pennies. Everybody, well, also because I wanted to eat, and I knew that most everybody didn't know how to cook, and I certainly didn't want to eat the food that they thought was good. You know, it just seemed yucky, the idea of what they might want to eat. So I would say, okay, let's buy some, I'll buy a can of beans, I'll buy some hamburger, I'll buy some tomatoes, or I'll buy some, you know, a can of corn, and we'll have chili. Ah, how, you know, that's pretty straightforward. And if you pack a bunch of teenagers full of good, hot, fresh chili, they can drink all the San Antonio Red they want and not get, you know, pukey, disgusting drunk on the beach. You know, I mean, they pretty much keep themselves together. I did spend a long time as a performer and a traveler, but even in that context, I always cooked.
Performing?
I was a folk singer. And I traveled a lot. I was in a group called the Women Folk. I started out as a folk singer and then was recruited into this group at its beginning. And we were the only all-female folk music group in the United States from 1963 to 66. And we had a hit record called Little Boxes, which very recently has been the theme for that television show Weeds. And this season, which is the fall of 2012, used our version of it. As part of their theme material. I've never seen the show, to tell you the truth, but I'm very thrilled and happy about the other thing. It's just very, very wonderful. It's both amusing and charming and wonderful.
One, two, three, let's all sing. Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same.
You'll find a link to the Women Folk website on the Spark page at WMRA.org, along with a link to Lenny Sorensen's own website. But wait, there's more. Lenny's back after a break and Bob Levicky's invitation to check this out.
And there's doctors and there's lawyers and business executives, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
And they all play on the golf course and drink their martinis dry. And they all have pretty children, and the children go to school.
And the children go to summer camp and then to the university, where they're all put in boxes and they come out all the same.
And the boys go into business and marry and raise a family in boxes made of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
Back before the break, good food foodie Lenny Sorensen was in the middle of telling us her life story, which certainly dances around food, but also includes being a member of the Women Folk, the only all-woman folk group from 1963 to 1966.
We traveled and did a lot of big television that was happening at the time, and we went to England and did the Ed Sullivan Show three times, and we did the Today Show and the Tonight Show, and we did the Red Skelton Show five times, and we did the Steve Allen Show and Hullabaloo and the Hollywood Palace and Merv Griffin, but what's his name? Yeah, maybe Merv Griffin. Yes, Merv Griffin and Mike Douglas. And anyway, and in the meantime, had quite a lot of fun. And then in the latter part of the 60s, I was in the West Coast Company of Hair.
Everywhere, Daddy, Daddy, Hair.
Yeah, do you want to talk about clothes on or off?
Oh, well, everybody had to do the clothes. That, I mean, that was part of... In fact, I think I was the first person contractually obliged to actually do the nude scene nude. But being a person that certainly at the time had very little body modesty, that was not actually something that bothered me. Or, you know, I was among the oldest members of the cast at the time. I was 27. Those kind of things just don't... That wasn't what was important about the whole thing to me at all. The music was cool. It was cool to be able to work with on a nightly basis a live band, because it was wonderful, wonderful musicians. And there's nothing quite as wonderful as dancing and singing to live, in a live performance.
Have any sense that you were, I bet you do, that you were part of the 60s history,
of course I was, but, you know, we were, I'm not a baby boomer. I'm older than the baby boomers. I'm almost a generation in many cases, you know, because I was 28 years old when I was in Hair.
Almost at the age you can't trust, 30.
Well, and I had lived through the 60s. Maybe at the beginning of the 60s, I certainly maybe couldn't have articulated why I had the feeling this was an important time. But as an age peer of Bob Dylan, you know, I wasn't like 17 years old and just discovered Bob Dylan and LSD in 1968. I had already been an independent person and working and traveling, and I had a child and had been married, and I was a West Coaster. So that it wasn't, again, those notions of whenever you come into something new, it depends on where you came from. And so being a person who was from the West Coast, I didn't find a lot of that stuff unusual or bizarre or life-changing.
It was indigenous culture.
I didn't come from the ordinary kind of family. You know, I didn't come from any kind of traditional family scene. I not only have no siblings, but my mother was married about at least 4 or 5 times. And at one point married Odetta's ex-husband. You know what I mean? I have relatives, and I know them, but I've never had anybody sitting over my shoulder with any right to say what it was I was doing. Hey. Now, that has its downsides and it has its positives. But I left my mother's house when I was 16, and that was in 1959. So, you know, I have been an independent person for a very, very long time, which means that through the 60s, I was not in rebellion against. Do you see what I mean? Me personally, I was not shucking.
You were just working.
I was just doing, I was trying to actually just earn a living so I could actually feed myself and pay my rent. And I happened to be a folk singer. And then I happened to, so I was a performer. That was primary. But even through all of that, I was always cooking because I like to eat good food. I am not going to not eat good food. And it doesn't matter if I live someplace where all I have is an electric skillet. The food is going to be as good as you can make with an electric skillet, which is sometimes really damn good, stomp on. And at the end of the 60s, I was teaching cooking even while I was still in Hair. By that time, things like Carla Emery and not the first Moosewood, because that was maybe 71.
It was the 70s.
Kind of the beginning of food co-ops and that kind of stuff. Well, there were just an awful lot of people who said, I don't know how to bake bread. Well, okay, we'll have a bread class and learn, And people who were just exploring the idea of eating beans and rice and grains. Well, we'll have a beans and rice and grains class, And I did it all out of my house because that's the kind of way I like to cook.
Got my red beans cooking. Really, my red beans is cooking. Ooh,
you like to be preparing food in your own home, don't you?
I like that one-on-one, hands-on. Yes, I like it in my house just because I tend to have tools that I'm familiar with and that I really enjoy using. I really like all the tools of cookery, be they older fashioned tools, hand-operated tools, or newer ones whenever I could afford them. Hell, I bought them. Do you know what I mean? Before I could afford a Cuisinart, but, to have the technology is fabulous. Some of this stuff is really great. And to do it in your own house means the kind of it colors the kind of food that you teach, I think. I may be wrong about this, but because it's not a formal cooking school environment that has a more of a, looks like a, feels more like a restaurant kitchen,
mm-hmm.
that kind of, my sense is when you learn to cook in someone's kitchen, you're more likely to be able to apply what you're learning in your own kitchen because you see it in that kitchen
context.
Thing. And then there's an informality. And even though I was very young, I still had the feeling that at some point I probably would get really old. And now that I'm really old, I get to say, you know, this is your grandmother's kitchen for people who didn't have a grandmother who cooked or didn't have a great grandmother that cooked, depending on how old they are. That's really possible.
I'm going to stop you because we're up in the present.
Okay.
And we left you being in Hair, performing in Hair and giving cooking classes in California, right?
Yeah.
How'd you get to Virginia? And you became Monticello's expert on African-American life and on Mr. Jefferson's food. How did that happen?
Well, I was always interested in not only in food, but I was always interested in history in a general way. I certainly was interested in African-American history as it was beginning to be written more and more and more writers and scholars
just
and all that
noticed.
Stuff. Yeah, I was always a big reader. And at some point, I went to Canada and I went to Ontario and I lived on a farm for a while. And in that context, kind of really got a feel for like big farming. I always gardened. My mother was a gardener. So I had a feel for that. Then I ended up meeting my husband and moving to South Dakota. Of course, it's much longer than that, but we're going to, for the space of time here.
Oh, no, let's just say there you were. Yeah, you spotted each other and said, let's go to South Dakota.
No, actually, we met through Mother Earth News, and that's a whole story. And I wrote an article about it, so one day somebody can go read that article. We moved to South Dakota, and we farmed on his grandfather's homestead land. And so since he actually had a childhood and young adulthood on the farm, in the farm community, and he's a carpenter, and he really knows, you know, all of the mechanics of everything from building and repairing tractors to, you know, all of that, combined with what for me was a good amount of book learning, because you can learn how to do things from books.
Mm-hmm.
Then you just have to gear yourself up to just go do them. Mm-hmm. They couldn't be that hard. Do you know what I mean? And it doesn't matter if when you butcher a pig, if it's messy. You know what I mean? If it doesn't look like something you got at the butcher shop, just eat it, get over it. For me, at that point, the newer part was learning to chop wood and use a wood stove and do all that stuff, which we did, and milk cows and raise pigs, and we had sheep and chickens and all that stuff, and how to sell them, try to begin to make a living out of them. And we were raising edible beans, navy beans and pinto beans. And then in 82, the Farm Home Administration closed out all the loans under a certain amount in eastern South Dakota, unilaterally closed us out.
Under, so only subsidizing big farm.
Yeah, thank you.
Big farm.
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
And we had to make a transition, and we decided we would come to Virginia.
Why?
Well, because we had a friend who lived here.
Okay.
No, she had come and been a kind of the assistant midwife when I had my daughter, and I'd come out and been the assistant midwife when she had her second daughter. So I'd been to Virginia, and at what I find amusing and wonderful is that I was here in March, and I went up to Monticello for the first time. Because during the Women Folk, we had never played in Virginia. We'd played in D.C., but we'd never played in Virginia for some reason. We had played in a number of Maryland and colleges all over, but for whatever reason, we just, as far as I'm able to recall. And so I'd never come to Monticello. And what really intrigued me was, of course, they called everybody the servants, which was so stupid that I could hardly bear it. But what was really wonderful,
however, they referred
to all the enslaved. Yes.
Yes.
You know,
as,
but that was,
as
this was 1980. So
yes.
You know,
okay.
Cut them some slack. But what was really great was it was March the 15th and they were setting cabbages out. Where I lived, it was still 20 below and the ground was frozen to 6 feet, you know, so it was really cool. So a couple of 3 years later.
It was really warm.
Warmish by South Dakota
yes.
standards. And I was out here for about 3 weeks and that was really cool. I got a good look at Alamar County in the middle of late winter, early spring,
yeah,
you know, which seemed like high summer compared to what I'd just come from.
Yes.
So. And, you know, sometimes things just turn out right. All the things in place, which if anybody who's been new to these areas know, it's really hard to find a good house to live in that you would enjoy. And it's hard to get a job, and it's hard. It always was. And a lot of it always depended on who you knew. These are not communities that you can just fall into, and you got to kind of pay your dues to be here. That's been our observation. And we just made some lucky connections, and my husband found a really cool job building, and we found a house. And so we made the transition.
So here you were.
Yeah.
Meet Virginia. Meet Virginia.
I arrived with 128 pounds of sheep's wool from my last shearing, and I went to an art center, and I asked, can you help me find some spinners? Oh, nobody around here spins. Which I was always amused. This was a person who was in the midst of constructing possibly one of the most ugly macrame constructs I had ever seen in my entire life. Anyway, I said, oh, okay, because she very, very strongly assured me that there were no spinners or weavers, that those were entirely mundane activities upon which nobody with an artistic bent would ever deign to engage. So I said, oh, okay. And I went home, and I put an ad in the Daily Progress. And this was in January of 1983. And in 2 weeks, I had a meeting with 14 spinners and weavers from the local regional area at my house. We ate. We looked at wool. We laughed. We talked. I got to meet them and folded me into a community of people who, while very low-key so that our macrame person didn't know they existed, were definitely around. One of them, who was on her way to leaving within the next month or so, said, oh, I've been a crafter up at Ash Lawn, and I bet you that you'd be good for that. I had never heard of a crafter. I had never basically seen a historic house, mm-hmm. you know, of any of that type mm-hmm. at all. I was used to the missions in Southern California. I said, oh, because I could spin and I could do a line of chatter. And also done a lot of reading. That was cool. So I went there, and Carolyn Holmes hired me. And I worked at Ash Lawn for 5 years and became, I was the director of the Colonial Crafts Weekend. I became an interpreter for the new kitchen, which my husband was part of building. So I really had a space that I could actually cook. Because the part of it that I really then, and I'm getting to your question, it's in a long way to get there.
Oh, take your time.
It was really cool to have a space in which one could cook in that hearth historic way that I actually knew quite a bit about, but had never had a setup to do. When I'd been cooking with my wood cook stove, that was out on the farm in South Dakota, and I didn't teach that. I mean, just about everybody that I knew that was into the same bag that we were all cooked on wood, so you know, it wasn't like I had did classes with anybody. I was just doing what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now I come to this place where it is possible to actually cook on a hearth, of which I have all these tools. I've got all this cast iron, and I've got, you know, and I know how to sew, and I know enough about history to be more than merely dangerous. You know what I mean? I have learned a good deal, and I began to learn a great deal more. In that context, suddenly there was a venue. It was like a performance venue is actually what it became.
Yeah.
And for me.
Yes. Okay, we're out of time on The Spark, even though Lenny Sorensen's story is far from over. Suffice it to say, Lenny went back to school, first through the adult degree completion program at Mary Baldwin College, then William & Mary, where she got her master's and PhD in American Studies. Lenny Sorensen's worked at historical homes all over the state, and for years was chief culinary and African-American historian at Monticello. But what Lenny Sorensen wants to do now is teach rural life skills, mostly out of her own Albemarle County kitchen. Do you let people decide what kind of classes you should offer?
I'm still kind of wobbling on that fence, to tell you the truth, trying to figure out the best way to do it. Over the last 2 years, I've had definite set canning classes where I've set dates and then people can plug into the dates. Now I want to get better at using the technology that we have to help people better plug in what dates are good for them and how to get paid online and all that kind of stuff. For the other stuff, how to offer that has been, that's something I'm going to be working on over this winter so that by the new spring season, because I want to teach between May and October. So I'm already out there doing what I'm doing with my animals and I've got a big garden and do all that stuff. Is how to figure to best offer those things. Like, I teach people how to make tamales. Well, making tamales is a really fun thing to do. It's a fun thing for a couple of couples. or a birthday present for somebody, and I'd be glad to do that on a custom basis. Mm. It comes under, of course, rural life skills only just because it's a kitchen thing. Once you learn how to do it, then hopefully you'll make tamales all the rest of your life.
As for me, I've put in a request to have an Aztec chocolate making class right before Valentine's Day. Anyone want to join me? If so, send me an email through the Spark page at WMRA.org or send Lenny an email through her website. You'll find a link to that as well on the Spark page at WMRA.org.